Hello, and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm the executive director at American Compass. And this week, we're bringing you a series of special episodes from our symposium on the new conservative story, held in late February at the National Press Club in Washington. Rana Forahar of the Financial Times, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, and David Lenhardt of the New York Times moderated discussions on the economic debate going on within conservatism, the political reality of realignment, and the challenges faced by media in covering these developments. Up first today, my introduction to the conference, and then Rana Forahar's conversation with Julius Krein, editor of American Affairs, and Michael Strain, director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Enjoy. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. This has been a project a long time in the making. At American Compass internally, it was called the What the Heck is Happening on the Right project. I wanted to just call the event What the Heck is Happening on the Right. I was told that's not nuanced and sophisticated enough. But the purpose of this conversation today is to discuss what the heck is happening on the right. What's happening in the GOP? What's happening with the conservative movement? Obviously, one thing The thing is Donald Trump at the moment. But, you know, what we have found is that in an important way, Trump is both a symptom and a cause of a much broader series of trends. I liken Trump to an earthquake. He is in some ways a disaster. He knocks a lot of things over. But importantly, an earthquake knocks over those things that are weak and outdated and poorly built and structurally flawed. And it provides an opportunity for building something better, building back better, if you're on the left of center, I suppose. And what you typically see after an earthquake is that those who liked things the way they were attempt to simply build the same things over again. And I think we saw this in the aftermath of 2016. There was an acceptance that Donald Trump was going to be president for 4 years, but especially looking across the institutions of the right of center, the publications, the think tanks, for the most part, congressional offices, there was sort of an attitude of heads down, this too shall pass, and then we'll get to go back to doing what we were doing before. And, you know, I was at the Manhattan Institute at the time and found myself in a community of folks that were, I thought, doing really interesting and important work thinking about what should come after Trump that should not simply be what 2016 would have sounded like if Trump had never come down the golden escalator. And yet that was to a significant extent invisible if you looked across the conservative establishment. So we founded American Compass in 2020 with the express goal of being the flagship for this set of efforts, being an identifiable platform, figuring out how to develop the vocabulary, bringing together a lot of the people who were doing the work to shape what would happen in the long run in the right of center that would be responsive to Trump, but also that would build something from a set of intellectual foundations that Trump himself seemed unlikely to provide. And I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress in doing that. What's really interesting in my mind, if you look at where we are on the right of center today, is that we are clearly in the midst of what the political scientists call a realignment. These realignments, as far as I can tell, happen roughly every 40 years in American politics, driven by one party or the other finding that its existing coalition is no longer a viable one. And that's what you would expect because things change. Coalitions are constructed at points in time in response to the interests of a set of people that overlap and in response to an agenda that addresses a set of challenges. For the Republican Party, that last happened with Ronald Reagan and the creation of what was called fusionism, the idea that you could bring together what was a set of very free market libertarian economic thinkers, social conservatives, typically drawing on a religious foundation, and Cold War hawks on foreign policy. What they had in common more than anything was an aggressive hatred of communism and determination to decisively win the Cold War. And they found common cause in doing that. They were obviously an extraordinarily successful coalition in that respect. But once the Cold War ended, it's fair to ask what did they actually have in common? I mean, if you think of someone like Friedrich Hayek, who was sort of the quintessential economist in this coalition, he has a very famous essay called Why I Am Not a Conservative. He disdained conservatives. And so to expect that conservatives would embrace his vision of economic policy for the long run probably is not realistic. That being said, when you have a successful coalition, of course, it holds together probably for as long as it possibly can. And what you tend to see is diminishing marginal returns and then even negative marginal returns until things get to a point where it is simply unsustainable. And I think that's what the Republican Party hit between 2012 and 2016. I remember those years especially well because I was working for Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign, watching Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. Obviously, there was an enormous political shift between the two. There were also some very real shifts in what we understood about the world. You know, all of David Auder's China shock research and the idea that maybe globalization and free trade with China had in fact caused the pain that people were saying it had caused was all a phenomenon, excuse me, of that time period. The same went for all the deaths of despair research. The idea that, in fact, for a significant swath of the population, not only were things not getting better, things were getting significantly worse. Suicide, addiction, ultimately declining life expectancy. That was all something that we realized during that time period. And so I think what we see then is a recognition among conservatives that things are going to have to change. What is probably anomalous in this process is that Donald Trump won. Typically, you get at this type of juncture in a political coalition a catastrophic loss. You get Barry Goldwater in 1964, leading to a long period in the wilderness where the Reagan Revolution was born. You get in the aftermath of Reagan wiping out Mondale in 1984, the Democratic Leadership Council, and the process that led to the rebirth of the New Democrats with Bill Clinton in 1992. And I think a lot of what we are seeing from the Republican Party and the conservative movement would make a lot more sense to us if Donald Trump had lost by 8 points to a semi-competent Democrat, which I think it is quite plausible to say he probably would have. And so we have all of this going on sort of underneath the surface, even as Donald Trump dominates the party in the foreground. But it's important to step back and realize that there is no clear Trump heir. You know, Trump as a person is an extraordinarily powerful political force. Trumpism, it's not clear if that actually exists. There are certainly many people who have attempted to emulate Trump as a political formula. They have generally been not at all successful. And if you look at the folks who really are laying the groundwork to be the leaders of the Republican Party in a post-Trump era, I would say it is found most in the younger Republicans in the Senate, folks like J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, Eric Schmidt. And you see some of those folks in the House, whether they're now departing in the case of a Mike Gallagher, though I suspect he will not be off the political scene for long, or a Jim Banks, who is attempting to move into the Senate in Indiana. If you think of that as what is likely to actually be the future of the Republican Party and the core of that coalition, I think it's a very clear and distinct post-Trump conservatism that doesn't look very much at all like what we saw before. So what does that look like? And what are we doing here? I'll describe just briefly American Compass's answer, and then the purpose of today is to hear from many of the folks leading this work, frankly, on both sides. I'll come back to that in a moment. American Compass's view is that the core of what is happening conceptually is a rethinking of both the ends of our public policy and the means. That in terms of the ends, the core of this Republican coalition in the Reagan era really took a quite libertarian view that we were not going to have a point of view on the common good, that we were not going to argue for a particular formula of success or the good life, and that really the power of economics was that we didn't have to, that everybody pursuing their own individual preferences could maximize their own outcomes, and the sum total of those would be the best outcome for the nation. we could have a long conversation about whether that is right or wrong. I would argue that it's wrong, and certainly I think quarter conservatism would be the idea that that's wrong, that there actually is a coherent concept of the common good that has to be at the core of our politics and that focuses on things like family and community flourishing and certainly aspires to economic progress, not to living in cabins in the woods, but recognizes that that has to be dependent on the actual underlying solidarity and strength of the society. And so that then leads to a very different set of policies. That means that tax cuts, deregulation, free trade are not automatically the answer. There are times when those policies might make sense, but there are times when those might be exactly the wrong policies. And so what you see in pursuit of those ends is then a very different agenda. You see much more skepticism of globalization. You see much more skepticism of financialization and the idea that a Wall Street-driven economy is likely to be a good one. You see a lot of interest now in organized labor and the idea that actually worker power might be as important as corporate power. And you see it in the renewed focus on family policy and not just talking a lot about family policy, but actually committing resources to supporting family formation and the raising of children. Lots and lots more about all of that at American Compass in our work. Obviously, we'd be happy to talk to you about all of it until you're very tired of hearing from us. But for now, I want to turn it over to our speakers for today. When you start to plan an event like this, you make a list of the people who, like, ideally, maybe one of them would come. And our list would be said, Rana Forahar would be amazing. Jerry Seib would be amazing. David Lenhart would be amazing. Let's start and see if we can get one of them to come. And they all agreed to come. And we are incredibly fortunate to have such a set of moderators who have really been at the forefront of covering this work and these developments on the right of center to lead these conversations. And then we have an extraordinary group of panelists. And as I mentioned, you know, I think especially importantly, we obviously have our perspective at American Compass. We see the value not in just blasting it into everybody's faces, but in having conversations amongst the different elements of the right of center who are grappling with these issues. And we're very proud and incredibly fortunate that we're able to bring together a group that will share a wide variety of perspectives and really give a sense of what these debates are about rather than just any one perspective on them. So with that, I want to introduce our first panel and particularly to introduce Rana Forahar, who really needs no introduction. She is global business columnist and associate editor for the Financial Times. Her most recent book is Homecoming, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World. And she is, if there were one columnist who I would make a point of reading every week, it would be Rana. So thank you so much for being here, Rana, and I'll hand it over to you.
Wow, Oren, that was, I'm moved and I'm touched. And I'm actually really honored to be here. Your comments just now resonated so, so much with me. You know, I'm actually not a conservative, as some of you may know. I tend to identify more with the labor left, but I grew up in rural Indiana. And what I'm finding that's so interesting at this moment is a lot of what Oren is doing, some of what's in Project 20 economically, these are things that resonate with me a lot, and I think resonate with increasing numbers of people on both sides of the aisle. Let me just set the stage and kind of amplify a little bit of what you've said with some economic thoughts, and then I'll introduce my two panelists. I think you mentioned, Oren, that politics changes about every 40 years or so. I think of the political economy and economic thinking in general in the same way. It's sort of like a pendulum, and it's purpose-built for its time. And you can go back literally hundreds of years and look at this, and you could say 18th century mercantilism sort of worked until it didn't, and then the pendulum swung, and we got laissez-faire, and then you know, maybe you get too much excess in the system and you get 1929 and then you get the Great Depression and then you get Keynesianism and you get more government intervention. And then when there's too much government intervention and too much red tape and perhaps labor has too much power, you get the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. And now we are at the end of what I believe is another pendulum shift. And I think, you know, I would agree with everything you said about Trump and Trump's victory. I grew up in a town and I'm still very close to people in my Indiana hometown that went 75% Trump. I was not at all surprised. In fact, the day of the primaries, I was sitting at a dinner party with, frankly, a bunch of very wealthy hedge funders and private equity people on the right that thought, no way is this guy going to win. And I was watching the TV and I was like, this guy is going to win. So here we are. And I want to really tease out in this panel what this pendulum shift means for conservative thinking about the economy. And you've already raised some of the key topics I want to cover: globalization, trade, China, trickle down, industrial policy. Some of these things are changing. Maybe they're changing too much in some ways. You know, where's the balance? So with that, let me come to the stage and introduce our panelists. And let me also remind everybody, we're going to have plenty of time for questions. We've got about an hour. So make sure you're thinking of those, and I'll start to weave them in after we've been speaking for a half hour or so. So with that, let me introduce Julius Krein, who is the editor of American Affairs. If you want to come up, I'm going to sit here and you can choose one of those seats. And Michael Strain, who is the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Can't think of two smarter people to be on stage with right now. Michael, let me actually start with you. I'm going to ask you all both the same broad question, which Oren has so nicely set up. What is changing in Republican economic thinking? Conservative economic thinking. Maybe you can kind of give me your three points there, big picture points, and then we'll dive in.
Sounds great. Let me begin by thanking American Compass for hosting this event, and especially thanking them for inviting me. I just want to echo something that Oren said, which is that American Compass has really shown a eagerness to engage with voices and ideas with which they don't necessarily agree. And I think that's to be applauded, it's to be emulated, and it really speaks to Oren's leadership, and it really speaks to the credit of the organization. You know, what has changed? I'll again agree with Oren that I think Trump has changed. Trump has changed the political right. And I think it's somewhat of an open question kind of how much of the changes we've seen since 2016 really stick. One big change that I think will stick is a hawkishness toward China. I think that was coming whether or not Trump won in 2016. You know, I think President Obama was more hawkish than President Bush, who was a little more hawkish than President Clinton. I think if Secretary Clinton, Mrs. Clinton, had won in 2016, she would have been more hawkish than President Obama was. And so this is just, I think, a trend. But I think that certainly will stick. I think a hostility toward immigration will stick. And I would draw a distinction between a hostility toward immigrants and a hostility toward immigration. I think President Trump embodies both, and many parts of the political right today embody both. I'm not sure whether a hostility toward immigrants will stick, but I think a skepticism about immigration will stick. Those are the two things that I really see sticking. I think everything else is kind of up in the air. At the risk of continuing to agree with Oren, I will agree as well that I do think the coalition is shifting. And one of the developments on the political right that I think is very favorable is a renewed focus on workers, on the working class, and a desire to really do something. I hope that sticks, but I hope that it is pursued with better policies than what we have seen coming out of not just the Trump presidency, but also the political right more generally over the last 8 years.
Great, great comment. Julius, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. And eight years after Trump came down the escalator, I'm still trying to answer it. I could make an argument that almost nothing has changed. I could make an argument that almost everything has changed. But I think what I'd attempt to do is to add to some of Michael's points, categorize some of these shifts a little bit. One category is the things that seem to be driven by, you might say, objective circumstances. And I think, you know, with regard to China in particular, complete deterioration of defense industrial base is something that is going to continue to push the right on issues around trade and industrial policy and things like that. Even those who do not necessarily agree on some of the larger macroeconomic debates behind this cannot ignore the fact that we cannot produce enough artillery shells, submarines, drone, what have you. The other piece of that will play out, I think, in the next few years is Trump's break on entitlements. The Bush era and Reagan era, there was kind of this promise, at least, that we're going to cut entitlements and Social Security, cut taxes. We're both deficit hawks and tax cutters. That was never really realized in practice, but the fiction was always there. And now I think it's not just Trump that's walked back from the sort of cutting Social Security stuff. Congressional leadership doesn't seem to want to touch that. Nikki Haley has run on it, but you know, we'll see. Doesn't seem to be going all that well. And, you know, now the deficit stuff is coming back in, I think this kind of tax cuts will pay for themselves. It's going to become increasingly difficult, and we'll see how that plays out in Republican politics. Then there's a whole raft of issues that I think are kind of primarily culture war driven, and both parties are culture war driven. But, you know, on the right, this can be things like big tech and antitrust and things like that. Sometimes that aligns with the culture war. Sometimes it doesn't. I think probably all sides will be disappointed around issues like that. It's not a very stable basis for policy reform, even immigration, which where I think the culture war is very solidly restrictionist on the right. There's still not that much energy in sort of policy reform and alternatives that I can see.
Wow. You know, everything you all have said is just, it's so fascinating because it all intersects and leads us to a potentially different place on policy. And Michael, I want to pick up on, and Julius, you know, jump in if you like, I want to pick up on this point about China, the industrial commons, and migration. And I want to put out an idea and see what you guys think about it. My sense of the neoliberal economic order, the Washington consensus, is that it assumed that capital, goods, and people were all going to sort of move equally freely and land where it was most productive. And there was a chink in that, which is that it worked really well for capital. It worked really well for financial interests. It didn't work quite as well for trade, and it certainly didn't work for labor. That is, if you agree with that, and I'd be curious if you do, that sets up a difficult dynamic, I think, to address, which is how do you really look after the interests of working people, the kind of people that voted for Trump, without kind of fundamentally changing the way you look at capital, the way you look at trade, the way you think about those things? How do you deal with state capitalism competing with China? You know, a system that 50 years is a short time span when, you know, we're dealing with quarterly capitalism. Big questions, but give me your top line thoughts, and then I want to dig into some of those.
I mean, I think the kind of Washington consensus or the neoliberal consensus, as you describe it, was more clear-eyed about the challenges than that. If you go back to the 1990s, for example, when the United States, you know, really did aggressively embrace globalization, there was an effort alongside of that to do quite a bit for the working class. And, you know, that effort was met with some success, but not with enough success. Trade adjustment assistance was a big part of the debate in the 1990s. In the 1990s saw major reforms to the social safety net. The 1990s saw a major increase in the generosity of federal earning subsidies to support workers and to make work pay. And so these things all kind of happened concurrently. You know, they didn't work well enough. And I think that there's no question but that policymakers and business leaders were too slow to realize that. But you know, there again, I think the story is more complicated. If you look at the places where Trump won, certainly deindustrialization was a major factor there. But that deindustrialization was overwhelmingly driven by technological advances. It was not caused by international trade in the main. The primary cause of that was technology. It was the adoption of robots and in factories and you know, increased efficiency and productivity from that. You know, Oren mentioned the China shock literature, which tells half the story. There's no question but that communities that were subject relatively more intensely to import competition had to make a transition. Most of those counties did make a transition successfully. Not all of them did. A large share of them are still in bad shape. But businesses and individuals in countries trade with each other, and that involves both imports and exports. Mm. And if you look holistically at the increase in globalization and in trade in the United States in those decades, what you see is that it basically had no net effect on the level of employment, which is what you should expect, because it's the job of the Fed to have maximum employment. It's not the job of trade. We gained a bunch of jobs in export-intensive industries. We lost jobs to import competition. And, you know, per usual, we focus on the half of the story that's negative.
Let me jump in. It's interesting because what I'm taking away is that you think the system as a whole, the kind of construct of how conservative economic thinking has been for the last 40 years or so, was pretty much correct, but that we needed to do more incrementally and at the margins. That's what I'm taking away from what you're saying, that there doesn't need to be some sort of a sea change in how we think about competing with China and the fact that you've got an industrial commons, as Julia says, that's been, in some cases, completely exported, which, by the way, you know, I was going back to my David Ricardo recently, and one of the things that I find quite fascinating about the classical economic thinking about globalization and trade and balances, Ricardo never thought that an entire industrial supply chain would be outsourced because, get this, he thought that the capitalists would be patriotic. Clearly, he never met, you know, the head of a global multinational. But so there is something. I mean, I don't want to get into it. You can make the argument that you just made, and we don't have to argue about tech v. China shock. I would actually say that they're all part of a system in which CEOs that are being asked by the financial markets to move costs off the balance sheets are making rational decisions to send things abroad. But Julius, I mean, you've raised a great point. I think it's one that's going to be in the news a lot more in the coming months. Ammunition, ships, the inability to, I mean, we haven't gotten into this, but the inability to make basic pharmaceuticals. What is the right response to that? Is it a 10% tariff? Is it some combination of increasing national competitiveness? I don't know what you think about Bidenomics. Jump in on that.
Well, I mean, I lean more toward industrial policy as the primary tool, and your tariff regime should be built around that. However, I think we do ourselves a bit of a disservice when we think about kind of neoliberalism in the conventional way. I think there's this story that, you know, 90s, it was all really about free trade, and then China or whatever took advantage of it with some subsidies. And, you know, in a way, if the purpose of a system is what it does, that was the whole point. And neoliberalism is its own industrial policy.
Mm.
And well, we fair. Simply chose to privilege non-capital intensive sectors over others.
Mm.
And we chose to go for intellectual property and financial rents over integrated production. And from a purely financial perspective, that makes a lot of sense. But from a larger strategic and longer term industrial base, productivity base, technological base perspective, we're living with the problems of that now. And I don't agree. I mean, certainly there have been massive change improvements in manufacturing technology. Most of them are in South Korea. The U.S. does not lead the way on pretty much any manufacturing technology. I mean, aviation, Boeing is a disaster. Chips, we've had to do a whole thing because Intel lost the lead a long time ago. Elon Musk the other day came out and said, if without trade barriers, Chinese autos will take over the world. So I disagree on that side of it, but I also think that what we've really just run an industrial policy that's in favor of, you know, consumer tech, education, things like that. And all government policy is a sort of, you're always choosing which sectors are strategic.
Mm.
Maybe those were the right decisions 40 years ago, but we're facing a new world now. And you're not going to be able to fix the defense industrial base without some larger effort on industrial bit.
It's really, I mean, I think you're landing on something important, which is that decisions are always political. You know, everything's an industrial policy in the sense that different interest groups are being prioritized or not. Maybe let's land on the concept of industrial policy, industrial strategy, whatever you want to call it, for a moment, because there are folks on the right, and Marco Rubio, Hawley, you know, that would advocate for some of this. I'm sure that many conservatives would say that Bidenomics goes too far. Michael, do you want to jump in on that? Do you think that there is any role from a strategy standpoint that the government should play at this point in meeting these challenges of state capitalism, short-termism, needing to prioritize people that have been cut out of the last 40 years of wealth creation? And what should it be?
So let me just quickly say that I don't think it's the case that all policy is industrial policy or industrial strategy. I mean, industrial policy is a set of policies that are designed to prop up a particular industry. We could have an industrial policy toward the low-wage services sector if we wanted to. We could have a substantially lower tax rate there. We could have substantial subsidies to businesses in that sector. And we don't do that. Instead, we have industrial policy to manufacturing. And, you know, there are, you know, reasons for that that maybe we'll want to get into later. But by the government saying we are not going to put our thumb on the scale for any given sector, that is not some sort of a neutral decision. Some people may think particular sectors are more important than others. I think a lot of people in this room think that manufacturing is particularly important. And it's very reasonable to argue that we should have an industrial policy for manufacturing. But let's be clear that the absence of doing that is not itself an industrial policy. To your question, you know, I think that China is a challenging situation, and particular policies toward China that you know infringe on the principles of free trade certainly can be appropriate. Now there are better and worse ways to approach that, but you know China has been breaking the rules. Mm-hmm. They forced technology transfer, intellectual property theft. You know, those are serious things, and it's completely appropriate for the United States to try and crack down on that. The right way to do that, in my view, is to assemble a coalition of nations, all of whom are being taken advantage of mm-hmm. in those ways, and to try and you know pressure China in that way.
Friendshoring?
Well, I don't know that I would call it friendshoring, but sure. I mean, friendshoring is better than look. I mean, if you imagine that everybody in America had to take a pill every day, and if you didn't take that pill, you died. Would you want that pill produced in Taiwan? Would you want that pill produced in Beijing? Obviously not. It's not obvious to me why that pill needs to be produced in swing states in the 2024 presidential election, but that seems to be, you know, the way that the United States said it and the president wanted. But much rather have that pill produced in Mexico or Vietnam than produced in Taiwan, even if that violates the principles of free trade. On your other questions, I mean, I do think it's very important. You know, the United States needs to do better at expanding economic opportunity. And the United States needs to do better at helping workers who have been displaced for whatever reason, whether it's trade with China, whether it's trade with you know, Canada, whether it's due to technology, for whatever reason. The United States needs to do a better job at helping those workers get back on their feet so that they can earn their own success in the labor market.
Okay, I'll come back to that, but I want to get your thoughts on particular industrial policy remedies. Do you have a kind of a 360 view of what industrial strategy should look like in the U.S. right now?
I think you look at the core incentives that are against capital-intensive sectors, which is where the problem is, tends to be both the preference toward financial rents and intellectual property changes. So I think you know, Bidenomics hasn't really addressed a lot of that. And we actually have not, we have done virtually nothing at all to leverage the, you know, vast American financial sector on these issues. You know, I've written on financialization. Obviously, finance has been part of the problem, but in the U.S. context, it absolutely needs to be part of the solution. I think proposals like Senator Coons, his IFCUS bill, and there may be some Republican co-sponsors coming on that, are probably the most advanced and most interesting proposals right now.
Break that down a little bit. What would that mean?
IFCUS is Industrial Finance Corporation U.S., so it's basically a development bank for strategic sectors.
Okay.
And it could do very, you know, from their conventional toolkit of subsidized loans or whatever to, I think, you know, really more pioneering stuff around milestone contracts and other transaction authority to, like, help companies bridge to, particularly in the defense space, getting the government contract, you know, you hit one milestone, you get more money, that sort of thing. A process, unfortunately, that's been very absent from CHIPS and other things. So I think other things would be like one of the big obstacles for critical minerals is price volatility.
Yeah.
So a vehicle like this could provide better hedging instruments and things like that.
Interesting. Okay, so let's stick with this idea of finance and financial markets. There's an interesting economist, Michael Pettis, who I'm sure you guys both know, who's doing a lot of writing around the fact that, and has worked with Lighthizer and others, the idea that in the current trading system, as the WTO is set up now, as we think about global trade, there's kind of three options. Option one is where we are, which is that we have sort of huge global structural imbalances where the U.S. is constantly the consumer of last resort. A lot of FDI gets pushed to the U.S. That creates more ability to financialize the economy. China remains the producer for the world, and you know we are where we are politically, and we know where that is. The next option is that
you get a revamp of the global trading system, maybe, Michael, something like what you're talking about, where a group of nations, probably the deficit nations, the US, UK, Australia, come together and say, hey, we need to actually start to revamp things a little bit. We need to have more balance in global trade in order to make sure that we're not prioritizing just consumption or production, and we have more of a balance. And then the final option is massive tariffs in order to rebalance things. And he actually has a new paper on Friday coming out on that, and it's going to be on the Carnegie Council website. Where are we in that discussion? Because I feel like in the next 4 years, trade and revamping the WTO is going to be a massive deal. And I would not be surprised to see some even more big political actions, maybe even a 301. Another 301. Thoughts? Where do we go from here? Where should we go from here?
I mean, I think that this entire conversation that we've been having for 8 years is colliding into reality. The reality is that the United States government cannot pick from a menu of options like that and you know, decide the world that it wants to live in. Countries don't trade with each other. Individuals and businesses in countries trade with individuals and businesses in other countries. The United States is a free society. And the type of economic police state that would be required in the United States to, you know, zero out the trade deficit or turn us into a country with a trade surplus is not a nation that anybody wants to live in or that anybody serious has a serious proposal for. The trade deficit is, you know, of concern if you are, you know, particularly concerned about manufacturing, though even there I wouldn't be all that concerned about it.
But why not? Why not?
Because we get money when we sell goods.
But what if we can't make ship and we are at war with China?
So there again, you know, like China, if you don't want that little blue pill produced in Taiwan, That should not mean that you are against free trade as a general principle. And if you were concerned about the size of the United States Navy, that should not mean that you are opposed to free trade with Europe or opposed to free trade with Canada or if we're opposed to free trade more broadly. If we're concerned about the size of the military, and I am, then we should increase the defense budget and we should build more ships. And we can do that without attempting to reconstruct the global trading order.
Julius.
Well, back to your question, I mean, China has made its decision. If you look at the shift in credit out of construction and everything like that, it's all going into manufacturing, particularly advanced manufacturing. I mean, they had already doubled down on manufacturing before. They're doubling down again. They've basically decided, you know, whatever middle class consumer model, like, who cares about that? We are going after the high tech industries, and I can see problems with that. But be that as it may, China has made its choice. So, you know, when it comes to like what should now, I do have to say, you know, one of the reasons the U.S. can't make as many ships is because we only have defense shipyards at this point. You don't have a commercial shipping industry anymore, so that bleeds into it. But I think when you look at like what are the choices facing the U.S. What's interesting is that it's basically three visions of austerity. There's kind of environmental austerity from the progressive left. There's the kind of, I suppose, old right austerity, which is, you know, we're just going to cut entitlements in government spending and deal with it. And I mean, interestingly, there is some economic theory about trade deficits and fiscal deficits. And I think the theory is like we just cut the fiscal deficit, you know, whatever. And then there's the final version, which is we have to shift from consumption to more investment, which is, you know, the one that I have, and I think the only one that actually leads to a longer term foundation for a better future. But in a way, everybody is being offered a choice of austerity.
That's a really interesting point. I could go deeper and longer and I could do a whole day on trade, but let me try and bring in some other topics, and I'm going to also start asking you all for questions in a moment. You talked just now, Julius, about China making its decision, big tech. I've been really interested in antitrust and how it's being revamped in this country. And there's a lot of debate over that. Obviously, the Biden administration's been very outside the box, kind of bringing back new Brandeis thinking. But for those that don't follow, this is kind of the idea that it's not just price that matters. It's not, we're no longer worrying only about consumer prices falling. We're going to think more broadly about power, political power, economic capture. This is the sort of idea that was used to curb, say, the railroad conglomerates. Now, that's being brought back now to think about big tech, the idea being that if Chinese state control of, say, critical minerals is a problem, then Google's control of information is also a problem.
TikTok's,
you know, well, right. But you could say either. What this administration says either, which is interesting. Let's get into the idea of antitrust, which to me, where that intersects, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, where that intersects with conservatism is the idea that we want a really, truly free market. We want a playing field that allows small businesses, that allows communities across the nation in various places to thrive. We do seem to be in a economy right now that veers towards consolidated power, be it in a big state or in certain handfuls of big companies. Michael, would you agree? How would you respond to that?
I certainly agree that we want markets to be competitive. And I think that there are practices that are anti-competitive that should receive additional scrutiny. I don't really see those as clearly in the market for goods or services as I do in the labor market. Well, practices like excessive occupational licensing regulation, for example, are kind of a classic barrier to entry that I think, you know, should be looked at. And, you know, that a lot of these regulations are at the state level, and so you need the federal government to kind of crack down on the states. Mr. Federalism, Ronald Reagan taught us how to do that when he got all the states to raise the drinking age to 21 by threatening to withhold their highway money. I think
that's a good fact.
I'm from South Dakota. We were the last.
I think threatening to withhold or doing something with job training money in exchange for making labor markets more competitive is an interesting idea that should be explored. You know, but with respect to the Biden administration's turn toward a European, you know, big is bad standard for competition policy, I think that's a, you know, pretty clearly negative development in my view. Big is not bad. There are very good reasons why we should expect big to be good. There are economies of scale, economies of scope that come with size, and the basic idea that in order to judge whether a market is competitive requires looking at whether or not prices are low, whether or not quality and variety of goods and services is high, whether or not there's innovation happening, is the right framework. The framework, and that can be threatened by bigness, or it can be, those goals can be advanced by bigness. Just looking at size doesn't tell you what you need to know. Telling regulators that their mandate is to, you know, police political power, I think really opens the door to regulatory mischief and threatens
subjectivity
and would, you know, likely end up with higher prices for consumers and lower consumer surplus and welfare in that sense. In addition, I think some of the judgments that are being made about political power strike me as mistaken, which only highlights the kind of danger of having a standard that's that subjective.
Interesting. Antitrust, Julius, if you could speak to the conservative viewpoint on this and where it should go.
Well, I think, you know, there are some people, Josh Hawley comes foremost to mind, that are very serious about this in the Republican Party, and I think have a deep commitment to it. There are a lot of others who, you know, have really mastered kind of exploiting the culture war dynamics around it, if anything, to kind of talk tough and then diffuse any action. And then at the state level, you know, you have a lot of interesting Republican state actions around app stores and things like that. So I don't know that there is a conservative or right consensus or real strong direction on it, but I think there's definitely some openness to it. It's not universally opposed as it may have been at some point in the past. And I guess I would also just make the point that antitrust in the U.S. is a very clumsy tool. I mean, the cases take 13 years and so on, though I think, you know, they've definitely had an effect in the last, Lena Khan and others have had an effect just through the signaling of it. And finally, there's a lot of connection just to foreign trade and other policies. A lot of the consolidation rationales over the years have been, you know, we have foreign competition. We need to, you know, allow consolidation domestically and then diminish domestic competition. I wonder, you know, if you do enter a Trump regime with 60% tariffs everywhere, maybe that comes back. But what's interesting is we've had a very bad habit in this country of sort of creating national champions through lax antitrust, but then not actually having them be national champions. So Boeing comes to mind. Right. We allowed them to become Boeing, but we didn't actually exert any, you know, golden shares or European style control over it. Yeah. So you just have failed fallen angels and failed national champions.
That's really interesting. I want to open it up for questions, and I have two more. I want to come back to migration and debt for sure, but let me just make sure. We got a lot of smart people in the audience here. We'll start over there.
Hi, I'm Maeve Sheehy from Bloomberg Government. Thank you for the question. I just, when you're talking about foreign aid or foreign affairs, something that really comes to mind is foreign aid to places like Ukraine, Taiwan, and that's kind of one of the biggest areas where we're seeing divisions on the right now. And I'm curious where you see issues like that going on this new center right that you're talking about.
Want to take that?
I think it's, you know, one, it's shockingly generational. But I think the new right has made it very clear that they're not interested in any more aid to Ukraine. I'm not here to debate the substance of that, but I think that is the position. And I think, you know, but I think there's also it's not a sort of Denis Kucinich style approach to foreign policy, if you remember him. It's more of a kind of, you know, we need to speak softly and carry a big stick model, and we actually don't have a big stick anymore.
Julia or Michael.
I think it is related to this turn inward and kind of retreat from the world that we've been living through for the last 8 years. We don't want to trade with anybody anymore on the political right. We don't like people who weren't born in America coming to America. I'm exaggerating, but just to make the point. And we don't like American leadership in security issues anymore. We are focused here at home. And this is the rhetoric that I think is used. I think walking away from globalization and demonizing immigrants are on par with retreating from global security leadership, and that all three are terrible ideas that, if continued, will accrue to the substantial detriment of the United States and of medium-term prosperity.
Any other burning questions right now? Otherwise, I want to focus on migration for a minute. One more over here, and then come back.
Santi Ruiz, Institute for Progress. The Biden team, in an election year, has been paying a lot of attention to regulatory issues that will make it harder to deploy capital through CHIPS and IRA in particular. How do you guys see that new interest in deregulation on the left meeting instincts on the right around industrial policy? It seems like the center left sees it as a new priority on specifically industrial policy.
Yeah, I was actually going to make that point in my opening remarks, but Rana runs a tight ship up here.
You can still make it.
So I'm going to do it now. No, I mean, I think while we're talking about all this, there has been a very real sort of pro-market turn. And it's precisely what you mentioned. All of a sudden, Democrats are really interested in environmental permitting reform. And it's actually shocking to me that the right hasn't been more enthusiastic about embracing it, whether it's kind of the older right or whatever who's claimed to always want this. I think, you know, all the voices on the new right also want it, perhaps for different reasons. To me, it seems like a missed opportunity of the last couple of years, and hopefully it won't be completely forgotten.
Look, I think it's, you know, I mentioned earlier that reality is colliding with the grand plans of national conservatives and progressives on the left. It is an example of why industrial policy does not work in practice. You can, you know, have a bunch of senators in the White House sit around and design a bill to revive the domestic manufacturing sector and to, you know, build all our chips here at home. That runs into practical challenges where the government has competing goals. How do those goals get resolved? On the one hand, the government wants to be very green friendly and protect the environment. On the other hand, the government wants to revive the domestic manufacturing sector. Those two goals are colliding. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're seeing is substantial political concern that the president's going to get up and give the State of the Union address, and none of the $50 billion that have been allocated, or very little of the $50 billion that have been appropriated are going to actually have been put out into the world. And so you've got center left people saying, hey, let's, you know, make it easier to actually spend this money by doing some permitting reform. And you've got the environmental left saying, whoa, 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 we have our goals too. This is exactly the kind of thing that happens every time the government tries to, you know, get out the wrench and the hammer and reshape the American economy. Mm. There are limits to the government's ability to execute the kinds of central planning that you're used to seeing on the progressive left, and that now you're starting to see on the right as well.
But I mean, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you supported the infrastructure bill, you called for paying for that with a carbon tax.
Mm-hmm.
So you're clearly willing to pick sectors. So this notion that, you know, government can never pick sectors, you obviously don't really believe it.
What sector am I picking?
You're penalizing fossil fuel.
Oh, well, look, I mean, you know, we could get into a debate
about it. We have different
priorities. We could get into a debate about the carbon tax. I think the United States needs tax revenue, and there are, you know, only so many places to look for it. And I would rather tax carbon than tax income. If you tax something, you get less of it. If you tax income, you get less income. We shouldn't want less income. And so let's go to taxing pollution.
Well, very, very well. Donald Trump would rather tax imports than tax income.
Yeah, we should.
And the
we
point,
should
the like point, imports. But the point is that people can pick sectors, and we don't have to turn it into libertarian hour every time someone brings that up.
I love it. Okay, I could let you guys keep going, but let me just make sure. I want to hit migration and debt, and then we'll have a few last questions. I had dinner actually with Kathy Hochul recently and was just like, I would not want this woman's job. The idea that we have, I'm from New York, we have a huge issue now with migrants in the city, but you go 3 hours upstate and you have tens of thousands of jobs that need to be filled. What would be the conservative solution to this?
Well, I don't know what the conservative solution to it is. You know, I think the United States has benefited enormously from being a magnet for some of the hardest working, most ambitious, most risk tolerant people born abroad, and that those immigrants have contributed tremendously to our economy. They have added tremendously to prosperity, and you know, I would also argue that they've really benefited the United States culturally. And the way that President Trump demonizes immigrants and the way that many on the quote-unquote new right demonize immigrants is akin to hanging a sign on the Statue of Liberty saying immigrants are not welcome here. And it is hard to imagine anything the United States could do that would be more harmful to our medium-term prosperity than that. Now, that view is completely consistent with opposition to a literal open borders, just to preempt the libertarian hour comment that I feel coming. And it is also completely consistent with a strong commitment to securing our borders and to zeroing out illegal immigration.
Mm.
We should be able to do these things. Whether or not that's the conservative view, I think is in flux.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend to speak to the conservative view. I mean, I think theoretically the solution on the table has always been the Canadian style point system based on economic need and things like that. And I agree with Michael on this one that, you know, if you're serious about better legal immigration, you should want to crack down on illegal immigration. I think, you know, unfortunately, the reality of immigration politics in the U.S. is that there are important lobbies on both sides that don't really want to fix the system along those lines. Mm. There are some on the right, agriculture and kind of low wage labor, and there are some on the left. Silicon Valley likes to take advantage of H-1Bs rather than even moving to something where you have a more streamlined, better system for highly skilled people. So I think unfortunately a lot of the public discussion of it is often just a TV charade, and what actually motivates things is completely different stuff that nobody talks about.
I think that's a very good point. Let me hit the other big sort of mega topic that's come up, which is debt and deficit issues and how conservatives think about that, particularly in the construct of everything else we've talked about. I mean, I am actually the rare Democrat that worries a lot about debt, maybe because I'm a Midwesterner.
Good of you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I worry a lot about it, actually. I guess broadly, how worried, Julius, I'm going to throw this to you. How worried are you about debt at a time when, if we extrapolate what I think it sounds like your worldview is, and certainly mine is, that we're moving to a bipolar, tripolar, more multipolar system in which the U.S. is going to be one power of many, that there's going to be potentially more conflict, more capital spending, that's inflationary. You might get, you didn't quite hit this and I didn't ask it explicitly, but if we assume that there may be some, I don't know if I want to say capital controls or more limits on what the capital markets can and can't do as a part of this sort of reindustrialization post-neoliberal world, what does that look like in terms of debt and dollar issues?
Well, I guess I just, you know, I think actually the most important things we could do on some of the industrial policy stuff are not that expensive anymore. Defense procurement reform, things like that, that doesn't cost anything. I think, you know, as I already said, there are three visions of austerity for the future. The American voter gets to pick between three visions of austerity. To me, the shifting out of consumption and investing into production is the only one that offers much of the future. I suppose I could be glib and say, you know, if you wanted to be a true Reaganite, you need supply side policy. It's the only way to get out of this. And today, industrial policy is the supply side policy. Simply cutting taxes doesn't work anymore. But, you know, I think just given the way the geopolitics look and what's happening there probably will be some, you know, more difficult choices that have to be made.
Go ahead.
You know, think about two different kinds of economic problems. There is, you know, imagine you and your family are kind of camping out in the woods and you hear a scratch on the door and you open the front door and there's a giant bear there and the bear is going to, you know, break through the door and you know, harm you. That's the way we talk about the debt. Mm. We talk about it as if it's a bear at the front door problem. Mm. But in reality, it's a termites in the woodwork problem. Mm. It's a problem that, you know, probably isn't a whole lot worse today than it was last month. But, you know, every month gets a little bit worse, kind of eating away at the foundations of your house, eating away at the foundations of medium-term and long-term prosperity. And it's very serious. So we should take it very seriously. There are, you know, three ways to deal with it: cut projected spending, increase projected revenue, and increase GDP growth. And I don't think that the United States faces necessarily a future of austerity. I'm an optimist about the United States. I think the United States should expect to have a prosperous future, and that expectation should not foster complacency. Mm. We need the right policies, but I think optimism about the future is empirically supported. And so I would, you know, first encourage Congress to enact a kind of pro-growth agenda that can help deal with the debt, which we can discuss. But then I do think we need to cut projected spending on Medicare and Social Security, that those cuts should hold harmless people who are near retirement, that those cuts should hold harmless low-income and working-class Americans and should be focused on the upper-middle class. And then I think we need to raise tax revenue.
Very quickly, what would your pro-growth agenda be?
Well, it would be an agenda that encourages private investment in the United States. It would be an agenda that increases labor supply, increases workforce participation. It would be an agenda that encourages innovation. And I think if you kind of get that mix right, then there are good reasons for optimism.
Mm. We've got only 5 minutes left, so I want to open the floor again. And if there's one or two more questions, go ahead.
Are there any deficit hawks left in Congress that, you know, you can recall either on either side?
They're a little quieter these days. You know, I think this gets back to Oren's opening comments and a question that we had earlier. You know, how deep is the support for the, you know, quote unquote new right? How deep is the support for Trumpism? It wasn't that long ago that the vice presidential nominee for the Republican ticket made his name through Medicare reform. And, you know, my expectation is that if Nikki Haley ends up winning the nomination, this cycle, or if a, you know, kind of more traditional Republican ends up winning the nomination in 2028, that the party will swing back on issues of fiscal responsibility.
Is there any hope for paying for increased spending by not playing tricks with the math on future spending that may or may not ever materialize, or future cuts that may or may not ever materialize either?
Either of you want
to? I mean, I don't know exactly what that means, but probably not. But I think, you know,
that's good and honest.
the last real deficit hawk was like Bob Dole.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't exist. And and you know, you can read what Bob Dole said about Jack Kemp and Reaganomics.
Mm.
Like, Republican deficit hawkery has always been fake, because it's always sort of the false promise that the tax cuts will pay for itself, and that, oh, we're actually going to cut Social Security and Medicare, but they're not actually going to touch that. And now maybe it's getting a little more honest. I don't know.
All right. I feel the need to wrap up, because we've only got about 2 minutes. We've covered a lot of ground. I almost wish, note to Oren, I would love to do a future all economic half day in which we could actually spend, you know, an hour on each of these topics. This is fascinating. I see a tremendous amount of new thinking. To me, there's a lot of opportunity still to bring sort of conservative ideas about decentralization and about really free markets into this conversation. National security is a topic I think we could delve more into here. We don't have time now, but I love being on stage with you guys. And I think, you know, we left folks with something to think about. So thanks to you both.